So this is side two of the 15th session, August 28, 2006. So we ended with this quote from Cliché Archetype on page 27 of my book, and this quote is from page 163 of Cliché Archetype by McLuhan and Wilford Watson. The quote is, like Alice, meaning Alice in Wonderland, like Alice, like, what was that? Are we okay?
Yeah.
Like Alice, Joyce pushed all the way through the narcissist looking glass. In other words, think of McLuhan's book title, Through the Vanishing Point. Joyce moved from the private Stephen Dedalus, who was the main character in Ulysses, along with Leopold Bloom. He moved from the private Stephen Dedalus to the Finnegan corporate image. That refers to the book Finnegan's Wake, which came after Ulysses. The mirror, like the mind, by taking in and feeding back the same image, becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience. So we're talking here about private awareness, as we had a few quotes back, and social public awareness or collective awareness. Private awareness of Stephen Dedalus. Stephen Dedalus was modeled on the ancient god Dedalus, the Greek character who was the first to note the relation between the ancient rituals and art, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so Stephen Dedalus is an aesthete, looking into being a writer and an artist and a poet. That's private individual's visual space concerns. But once we get into the radio era en masse, and Joyce stimulated by writings like Wyndham Lewis's writings, the new media effect, by in the 20s and 30s, the new electric mass media effect, Joyce is looking at the corporate mind. And he's probably relating the private stages of apprehension, drama of cognition and recognition, back to tribal rituals, because he's seen tribal rituals being retrieved all around him in Europe. He's living in Paris at this time. So now the mirror, like the mind, by taking in and feeding back the same image, becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience. The mind takes in an image of the world, turns it upside down, alters it according to the individual brain chemistry, and then projects it back out. So it's a combination of matching and making going on there in the drama of cognition, or of taking in the sensory world, miming the sensory world, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the mirror is an image of a visual technology, one which evokes matching. But the mirror, he's saying here, McLuhan is emphasizing the making part of the mirror, how it takes in an image and reverses it. You know how when you look in a mirror, it reverses your own image, right?
Right.
It flips it. So taking in and feeding back the same image, it becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience. I think he means there that it's a model for the way one medium, one word, evokes all the other words. And that's a cycle or a wheel, and it can retrieve all experience. And so then we get to the...
And so how is he using the word narcissus here? Like Alice, Joyce pushed all the way through the narcissus looking glass.
He defined narcissist in understanding media as someone hypnotized by his own image. And the narcissist looking glass in this context is visual space. In other words, Joyce got past the Gutenberg hypnosis of the effects of the book of visual space and individual private awareness represented by Stephen Dedalus in Ulysses and began to see beyond visual space and to see multi-senses and how media were extensions of those. Therefore, he has broken through the collective hypnosis that everybody was under during the Gutenberg galaxy phase.
Yeah.
It's a collective narcissist.
Yeah, because visual space gives us a certain image of ourself, which falls apart in the multisensory world.
The consequences of visual space are the images of visual space.
Yeah.
The consequences of the images, if I put the word visual space in there, the consequences of the visual space are the visual space of the consequences.
Hmm.
So the next quote builds on this. So you see, I'm building on this important, using these different quotations to show someone there's a parallel between a deeper way of understanding the central nervous system. It involves memory, mind, mirrors, drama of cognition and recognition, probing, scrapping, retrieving, the collective extension of that. You see?
Mm-hmm.
The depth of what McLuhan's dealing with is what I'm trying to create. That's the effect here by showing these different quotes. As you'll see, we continue along the same thinking in the next quote, which is from page 163 from Cliché Archetype.
The whole of Finnegan's Wake including the title, is paradox, based on what Joyce considered man's greatest invention, the mirror of language, the, quote, magazine wall of memory that all, of memory and all human residue.
Yeah, the whole of Finnegan's Wake, including the title, is paradox, based on what Joyce considered man's greatest invention, the mirror of language, the magazine wall of memory and all human residue. It's like saying that language as speech, though Joyce was showing the multi-level meanings of language, but if he did mean just speech as the greatest invention, then speech evoked all other media that extended from it. And so it was the original magazine wall, which is a key motif image in Finnegan's Wake in the book, the magazine wall of memory and all human residue, which is echoing the mirror like the mind. By taking in and feeding back the same image becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience. The mirror like the mind, the mind is like language. So the mirror like the mind of language, by taking in and feeding back the same image becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience. It's a paradox, and so that's why in this next quote, the mirror of language is the magazine wall of memory and all human residue. So, I mean, Joyce writes Finnegan's Wake dumping all these languages into the book, plus post-verbal movie, radio, and magazine pictorial dynamics of language are presented in the book. So the idea of paradox, I'm assuming that tribal awareness accepts paradox, doesn't even think of life as paradox. Once you have visual space, then you start looking for one meaning over another, and you start to lose your sense of paradox in communication. And by the time you get to the 19th century, science is not looking for paradox. It's trying to clean up paradox. It's trying to find the exact single cause and single effect, match them up, right? But the poets in the latter part of the 20th century really started to emphasize the paradox of communication. The symbolists started it, and then Pound, Joyce, Eliot, and the rest of them brought in paradox. So you had what was temporarily called the division between art and science. The art being the humanists, they would emphasize the effects and the paradoxes of progress that the scientists were inventing. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So the artists were studying the effects, and they would not dismiss paradox. They'd say that it was telling us something that the scientists are not paying attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to the next quote.
When you say the temporary division between art and science, that was a, sort of a permanent division.
Well, by the 70s and 80s, McLuhan said art and science had merged. Matter of fact, he said that they'd switched places. And if we looked at
not in the normal way that people think about it. I mean, people still go to school and they either study the arts or the sciences. They tend to go in one branch or the other.
Yeah, in Western consciousness, Western's cliche, visually biased situation, they continue doing that. But we know that more and more science has become corporatized, and many scandals about the rigging of studies. Science is a separate discipline, is struggling to maintain its integrity because the actual takeover by imagery, and the word makes a market, and that whole world of the satellite environment and the digital world, the Android meme, where what George Bush says is the science and the art. The information design becomes the real control in life. So the old visual space separate activities of art and science have been in crisis through most of the last 60 years. I'll just leave it at that. Yes, the culture continues, you know, frozen in its own archetypal meme, keeps training kids, but the kids become either totally devoted toward getting into business and aren't interested in the humanities, and the humanities becomes a ghetto, and the scientists move into computer emphasis in the courses, it gets rather confused. So McLuhan foresaw the weakening of the differences between art and science. In fact, he said, if I remember, it's in Take Today, he said, art has taken on the role of being like science, while science has taken on the old artistic role of creating new images and new movements. For example, the discovery of all the particles, and they keep changing, and revolutions and new kinds of particles. Now they even have string theory, which is not proven in any traditional scientific way. I mean, you see it on Jack Sarfatti's list. He has physicists commenting. They don't know why string theory's taken over, since it's not verified in any normal sense of science that proved previous theories. So I say the string theory is an evocation of, since it's based on musical ground, it's a retrieval of acoustic space as archetype. So without going too much into that, very present dominant theory of string theory, dominant model string theory, at least in the way the media presents, the fashionable media presents what's developing in science, string theory is a very bizarre product of this new situation. It's almost like a Andy Warhol soup can in the museum. People said, is that art? You know, he's taking something from a factory and replicating it. Is that art? Now the scientists have the same problem. Is that science when they deal with string theory? So the effects in both divisions are results and images of the consequences of the new media design world. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yes, this culture insists on maintaining the categories. And that's partly what the right wing is. The neoconservative movement politically is an attempt to maintain visual definitions, visual space values. Okay, so let's go into the next article, the next quote. I think the next few quotes, we're still dealing with what does McLuhan mean by creativity? Because he says in the famous Playboy magazine interview, he says that Joyce, Eliot, Lewis, Pound, Yeats had discovered the identity of the creative process. And that is an interesting statement. And so he's building on that and showing how the creative process has been extended into the electric media environment. He said the central mystery of human cognition has been externalized by the television environment. So this section we're quoting is where he's wrestling with what is creativity in a world of excessive scrapping, probing, and retrieving. And he's taking William Butler Yeats' poem on his own personal creative understanding, his own understanding of the creative process, using garbage. And McLuhan's saying even that has a problem today, since we don't know what garbage is anymore. Right? So we will come to this next quote, and supports, enhances what I just said. Let's go to it. This is the next page, page 29 of my book, right-hand page in the McLuhan column, and it's another quote from Cliched Archetype, page 184.
In literature, works like Eliot's The Wasteland, Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, and Beckett's Waiting for Godot are concerned with destructive aspects of the enormous creativity of the electronic age. All of pop art, funk art, op art, and various other versions of mini art reiterate the process by which cliche probe destroys and creates.
In economics, Schumpeter was the economist who came up with the theory that capitalism is more powerful than socialism because it's based on creative destruction. Every new innovation destroys what's happened, but it leads to new breakthroughs which create more profit. So in economics you have that model, so we have it here, destroys and creates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would make sense, because if in the socialist, if the old model doesn't get destroyed, it just keeps perpetuating itself as the old model.
Yes, and it may have justice and everybody has a job, but media environments are swirling around in the rest of the globe, and they eventually affected the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union could not keep up with the rapid creativity surrounding it in the rest of the world. It just needed new computers,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't have it. The system broke down. But they were like media ecologists in the sense of stopping technological progress, trying to maintain social justice, and cause all kinds of contradictions.
Mm.
So here's McLuhan talking about, in literature, works like Eliot's The Wasteland, Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, and Beckett's Waiting for Godot are concerned with the destructive aspects of the enormous creativity of the electronic age, you know, the disservice. And then later, pop art, funk art, and op art, and the various other versions of mini art or minimalism reiterate the process by which cliché probe destroys and creates. So we're in the world of cliché probe. Remember the previous quote? Four quotes back. The present probe tests cliché as the current technology. And we've been spelling out how there is no garbage heap as we have breakdown by so much probing and environing. Five quotes back. And another phrase, we probe all and scrap all in a deluge of fragments of cultures. Fragments of cultures, that's all that's left, is fragments of cultures, which are like older media artifacts, whereas the real global culture of simulation is going around all the cultures and fragmenting them. But we retrieve the fragments from old cultures for creativity. Now, you just let's think of all the museum shows you've been to or have heard of, Tutankhamun, endless exhibits that when you were in L.A., you and Jerry used to go and see them. There were fragments of previous movements, a lot of it. Previous cultures, that's what you go see.
Mm-hmm.
A museum in itself is archetypal because it contains all the garbage from previous cultures. I know in the 90s here in New York, the museums did a lot of recycling of movements, showing the history of all kinds of art movements and different trends in art over the last hundreds of years. It's like they had nothing more to do. They were left to become just retrospectives of old fragments of old earlier phases of technological upheaval, which usually the art movements reflected through the last 200 years. So the ongoing cliché probe destroys and creates. And you have these rapid movements, pop art, funk art, op art, and mini art. All of those had revivals in the 90s. They would give retrospectives of those movements in the different museums in New York City. It was a decade of retrieval, or of the art world just looking back at itself, navel-gazing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a hyper archetypalization of its own role, of art being a way of looking back. I mean, art is, by definition, a cliché probe, and new art looks ugly, but then it becomes accepted because it mirrors the technology that evoked the art, the new environment that evoked the art, and then eventually people get used to it, their sensory ratios get adjusted, and then the art form becomes the establishment, in quotes, or accepted.
Does any of this relate to the quote a couple pages ago where he says something like, beautify junkyards, throw something beautiful away today?
Yeah, that's the same process. The junkyard is the global garbage heap caused by electronic and satellite environments. So instead of saying everything is, nothing is garbage anymore, you then flip that and say everything is garbage, but it doesn't have any anti-environmental or artistic role, so you beautify it by throwing something beautiful away. Another paradoxical statement about this problem of the destructive aspects of the enormous creativity of the electronic age. You can see the whole theme of...
It's like I'm getting the image that we're inside a huge compost heap.
Yeah. And that's what the main image in Finnegan's Wake is, what he called the midden heap, which is like a garden compost pile.
Mm-hmm. Instead of composting organic materials, we're composting technological artifacts.
Yes, but everything is technological in McLuhan's term.
Mm-hmm.
Medium refers to all artifacts from all cultures. It's only the Western world that says this thing is technology and that's something else, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's still the distinction between first and second nature, but technology refers in media, in McLuhan's terms, as all forms of language.
Yeah, the distinction between first and second nature is what I make, and that's like a setting up a distinction between cliché and archetype. They're actually interchangeable once you understand what's happening, and you realize that humans are always describing first nature in second nature terms, and therefore second nature is all that we experience. We don't, all that we know, it's very hard for us to know first nature.
Yeah.
Because McLuhan used to point out that new media are nature. So So the division between first nature and second nature that I make is a temporary dialectic that has to collapse on itself.
Yeah. It's still hard to equate a tree with a computer when we talk about nature.
Right.
The computer is clearly man-made and the tree is not. Now, we define the tree in terms of the biological sciences and horticulture and like that. We have all these classifications for plant materials and all that kind of stuff. So in that sense, we transform it into models of language. But when you're sitting there communing with a tree, you know, you're not thinking about what the species of tree it is necessarily. You're just sitting there as a tree, and it's not a computer. It's first nature.
Right, and McLuhan wrote in a magazine article, Canadian magazine article, I think it was McLean's magazine, it's like Canada's national magazine back then, in 1967, at Christmas, December issue, he's talking about the Christmas season, and he says, in the near future, the star that you pray to or sing hymns to, Catholic, or what do they call it, Christian carols to, the Star of Bethlehem, he said, those that you sing to may be man-made. So in the future, with nanotechnology or whatever technology you're going to come up with, the tree you're meditating from may be totally man-made, right?
Sure, but that doesn't apply to the present.
Right. So people, we're at this point where we have to decide our relationship between what seems to be nature and what seems to be non-nature. That's a big crisis in the 20th century, especially with the ecological movement and all the kinds of dropoutism and Ludditeism and movements to stop the destruction of nature. Amazon forest stuff and all that. Global warming. What McLuhan would point out is that, yes, a computer's not a tree, but he would say, how do I know tree without the word tree? And that gets you into language, and then it gets into human communication, and then the problems of communication about the destruction of first nature get exaggerated, get confused by new forms of communication.
Yeah. But I think you can know a tree without having a label for it. You don't have to have a label for a tree to know a tree.
Well, that's what psychology, cognitive scientists look into. They're looking at how the child forms awareness of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And without someone pointing out things, you may not perceive them.
Now, there was an interesting, it seemed to come from a reliable source, so I assume it's true, but I heard that one of the Spanish guys that landed in South America, the first guys in the old wooden ships, I don't know if it was Cortez or... Maybe I'll just say it was Cortez, that in the ship's log, the captain noted that the natives could not see the wooden sailing ships. They looked out into the ocean and saw an unbroken horizon, and then all of a sudden they'd see these guys in fancy outfits pop out of nowhere in rowboats landing on their beach. And the shaman had to teach them how to see the ships because it was outside of their perceptual domain or their language of communication.
Yeah, and then pointed out to them, and they had to take some authority to point it out.
Mm-hmm.
Just like for a child, the parent is the authority and points out and shapes the child's brain.
Yeah.
But then you put the child in front of television or radio, that's shaping his brain too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or sensory ratios.
Yeah. But I don't think anyone ever had to be trained to see a tree. I mean, The ship was a form of technology that was just outside of their consensus reality, but trees, and they're part of everybody's consensus reality.
Only once they're pointed out. A child doesn't know there's a tree.
I don't know. I don't know if he does or not.
Well, we may not. That may be the mystery of nurture and nature. You know, that may be something we'll never resolve, that question.
Mm-hmm.
But for someone who says the child would know it without the parent, there's equally 50-50 argument on the side that no, the child wouldn't know it unless there was the parent.
Yeah.
I mean, the parent is helping it.
Well, when the child learns to walk, he bumps into a tree, he's got to acknowledge that there's something there, and he's going to look at it, and he's going to see what it is, and it's going to be a tree.
But he was molded before that. with sensory knowledge to begin to walk.
Yeah.
So the those are questions that McLuhan is prompting. Let's see. So we're talking about the cliche probe destroys and creates. You see here where he lists pop art, funk art, op art, and mini art. That's five art movements in about 6 years in New York City in the 60s. You know what I mean? Maybe even less, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's how fast those movements came in the 60s. And it's the art world, capital A art world, responding to all the other media, which by the 60s, McLuhan says the media are the art forms, not necessarily the capital A art world. Art, the capital A art world is just reacting to the effects. So he's saying that Joyce and Eliot and Beckett are concerned with the disservices of the enormous creativity of the electronic age. Then you come to the next quote, page 184 of Cliched Archetype. What's it say?
How to elicit creativity from these midden heaps has become the problem of modern culture.
Right. How to elicit creativity in the sense of anti-environments, a way of understanding what's going on. And that's the very question that McLuhan is writing about. And he's talking about how these previous artists identified the process of creativity, and then they see it extended in the environments. Then how can you be creative as an individual or as a society in relation to this enormous destructive and hyper-creativity? And nobody uses the word midden heap.
Yeah, well, he hijacks that from Joyce.
Yeah.
And what context does Joyce use it that he wants to hijack it for this context?
Joyce understands the world has become a garbage dump. I mean, the midden heap metaphor is the main metaphor Joyce uses as a result of his dialogues and studying of Eliot, Pound, and Yeats, and Lewis, and many other people. But a big factor is those guys. I mean, they had an ongoing dialogue among themselves. There's a book out by an English professor, British professor Dennis Brown's, called The Intertextual Dynamics of the Literary Group. I refer to it in my essay, Up the Orphic Ante. That talks about how each of the Eliot's, Joyce, Pound's, Lewis's works were commenting on each other. And they're all wrestling with this problem of the role of very talented individuals themselves, capital A artists, how do they deal with the new mass culture of technological art?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so the midden heap of many media environments, what we call industrial pollution, is not just machine pollution, it's software pollution. The millions of magazine articles that came out in 1922, say, right? Just one medium in one town, or one big city. That's just one thing. Then there's the records and the movies and the soldiers and the wars and the terrorism and the espionage and all that went on. All the labor, too. All of that is massive creativity. In the 20th century, that's why it's silly to talk about people being dumbed down. There's not a dumbing down going on in the conventional sense. There is hyper-awareness, but how to express it and get control of the massive plundering of the midden heap is a question for serious management, which is the intelligence agencies. How to elicit creativity from these midden heaps has become the problem of modern culture. To the degree that we are failing to elicit creativity for human beings, they appear to be dumbed down.
Yeah, I remember Terence McKenna liked to use this. I don't remember exactly the context that he was. Yeah, he was talking about how kind of culture. He was making a metaphor for the way that culture is created. He talked about these little, the little plankton creatures that live in the sea that excrete calcium. And they and so through this process of excreting calcium, they create these huge coral reefs. But the coral reefs are just excrescence. But the coral reef then becomes the structure inside which these things live.
So they excrete it in something, and then they live inside it.
They excrete calcium, and in the process of excreting calcium, the calcium builds up in the form of these coral reefs, which they then live inside of.
Right. Well, it reminds me, Wyndham Lewis said that he was a vorticist, which emphasized machine as art form, and how humans were mechanical puppets. sort of like a blatant medium is massage effect. Lewis said he kind of dropped the vortices attitude when he realized all forms in the machines were in nature already. And that's another way of saying that the house mimes the lines of nature, that everything we're making is extending first nature.
Mm-hmm.
And
I wonder, in terms of this midden heap metaphor, I wonder if you know, if it would be close to what he was thinking to say that technology is, in a sense, what we excrete. And we're sort of, but you know, and so, and then it becomes the structure in which we live. So,
right, you know, he uses to point out how the mind, the mirror of the mind, takes in the external world and makes a new image out of it.
Mm-hmm.
He said it's the same as when we excrete. What we eat doesn't have the same color as what we excrete.
Mm-hmm.
It's altered in the digestive process.
Right.
And so the coral, this creature that creates the coral, it lives in there, but it can only live in there. It only creates one environment. But humans create many environments which affect previous environments and incoming interpretations of new environments, future excretions, and it's a more complex ecology in the human world.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you could take nature does this in specific contexts, but we really are like tactile. We really play with it and expand its range.
Mm-hmm.
The basic forms that are in nature, when we start excreting them, then we get a whole separate ecology among those forms that we made it that were imitating the process in nature.
Yeah.
And
becomes, in LaRouche's, the way that he thinks about it, it then becomes embroidered into nature so that... like you said, if you pulled technology out of nature, nature would collapse.
Yeah.
And LaRouche sees humans as helping to develop nature, as co-gods, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Help to grow nature. Let's see. So the midden heap is, as we have a turnover of you know, great creativity in the 19th century, and then even more in the 20th century. McCune would say that there was hardly any invention in the 20th century, but I think you're talking about hardware invention. All the hardware invention was done in the 19th century, and then the software invention took over in the 20th century, which is still invention, but on a different level than the hardware machine level. And the turnover of those software media really created a lot of garbage heaps. Like, you know, the whole process of begin with the last word, that's the latest technology. Becomes cliche, then it becomes art form, and then becomes archetype. Or from the museum point of view, or the visual space point of view, or the magazine wall of memory and human residue, they just pile up and look like a junkyard. But the junkyard then got ransacked by the middle of the 20th century. And we move beyond the idea of a midden heap. So the midden heap is a term that Joyce uses, but McLuhan updates it and points out that we don't know what the midden heap is anymore, and we may not even be there. Which may be implied in what happens in Joyce, because he has a metaphor for the book, Finnegan's Wake, when Belinda Hand discovers the old manuscript in the midden heap. And then the scholars try to figure out what the manuscript's saying. That's Joyce mirroring people trying to figure out what Finnegan's Wake is saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a parody. So how are we doing with the time?
We got 15 minutes on this tape.
Okay, so that quote, page 184, let's go back and read the two quotes again. And let me see, maybe three quotes. I put four quotes in here, replay them, so we can get the overview. Like Alice in Wonderland, Joyce pushed all the way through the narcissist looking glass. He moved from the private Stephen Dedalus to the Finnegan corporate image. But that corporate image, you know, is a midden heap, right? So think of the midden heap, the creative cliche probe and destructive principles, all this happening. Do this again. Like Alice, Joyce pushed all the way through the narcissist's looking glass. He moved from the private Stephen Dedalus to the Finnegan corporate image. The mirror, like the mind, by taking in and feeding back the same image, becomes a wheel, a cycle, able to retrieve all experience. Next quote. The whole of Finnegan's Wake, including the title, is paradox, creative and destructive. I'm throwing it in. The whole of Finnegan's Wake, including the title, is paradox, based on what Joyce considered man's greatest invention, the mirror of language, the magazine wall of memory and all human residue. In literature, next quote, in literature, works like Eliot's The Wasteland, Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, and Beckett's Waiting for Godot are concerned with the destructive aspects of the enormous creativity of the electronic age. All of pop art, funk art, op art, and the various other versions of mini art reiterate the process by which cliche probe destroys and creates. Next quote. How to elicit creativity from these midden heaps has become the problem of modern culture. And so what does he mean by creativity there? Because obviously there's a lot of creativity going on. So McLuhan's definition of creativity was in a sense, getting a perspective on your time through looking at it via another model. And the model wasn't any environment. McLuhan used to say that the artist takes the old environment and replays it in the rhythms of the new so that he preserves the old environment but gives it new resonance with the new effects. So then we get to the next quote, which is from page 188 of Cliché d'Archétype.
One question on the last series of quotes, the first one you read, where he refers to the mirror of language, the magazine wall of memory. Why doesn't he say the TV wall or the book wall? He says the magazine wall of memory.
The magazine wall is a major metaphor in Finnegan's Wake.
Oh.
And he's discussing Finnegan's Wake. And the magazine wall was an actual military installation in Dublin. It was like where they kept the ammunition, where they maybe...
Oh, that's right.
Closer to the entrance to the harbor, they could shoot down ships coming in, you know? It was
mm-hmm.
kind of storage of ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
The magazine wall.
Oh, so there's a double entendre there.
Yeah. And he's talking about old hardware magazine, military hardware, and then the new software, military imagery, that he could walk into any store in Paris and be all these magazines.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, he's using a pun to bridge both the old hardware world and the new software world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the magazine... You have normal human memory based on speech, and then you have book memory based on print, and then you have the memories created in the 20th century by movies, magazines, photographs, radio,
mm-hmm.
that memory gets virtualized.
Mm-hmm. So would you say there's a TV memory, or are we beyond memory by the time we get to TV?
Well, McLuhan said in the 70s, by the 70s, he said people had a nostalgia for forgetfulness, and they were starting to... consciously engage in social amnesia as a social mask because the computers and databanks knew more about anybody than they could remember. So as an anti-environment, an instinctive resistance to that effect, McLuhan said people were starting to go around pretending they couldn't remember anything.
Hmm. Like Alzheimer's is a fairly... Do you think that's a fairly new disease, or it's just getting more attention now?
I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I mean, we'd have to ask Carolyn on that, but some people think Alzheimer's is caused by the polluted foods and polluted and toxic environment and has people age that way, but you know, others might say, no, that's just what we used to call senility, right?
Yeah.
So that's a medical question for the medical specialists. But we have social amnesia or what disease...
Alzheimer's.
I got it right now. Alzheimer's disease, the idea of not being able to remember, it's like the chemical body's version of a collective social amnesia that people were engaging in more and more. I mean, even Reagan, he got Alzheimer's, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. But remember in the late 80s, he, in the Iran-Contra scandals, he would wake up the defenses he couldn't remember.
That's yeah.
A cliche point about Reagan.
Yeah.
But he was expressing what everybody else was using as an alibi.
Yeah.
I remember... Julius Pfeiffer had...
He may have gotten so caught up in the notion that he couldn't remember that he brought on his own Alzheimer's.
Right. Some people say, though, that he doesn't have Alzheimer's. It's just an excuse so they don't bug him about state secrets.
Oh.
I was going to say, yeah, Julius Pfeiffer had a really great cartoon once about this woman who talks about how she forgot she had a husband, forgot she had a family, forgot she had a home, and then she went on her way. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He was picking up on, you know, in the cartoon medium and expressing a syndrome that was going on.
Right.
And so he shows the syndrome without naming the causes.
Well, right.
Moon would come along and try to propose the causes of that popular effect.
Right. Then there was another effect. I don't know if it was along similar lines where... The proud mother shows off the baby, and the woman says, "Oh, he looks just like his picture."
Yeah, no. The joke McLuhan used to say, "Well, that's nothing. You see its picture." So that's a joke that shows the question whether culture is nature or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to camp, the phenomenon of camp. These are two more quotes from the book Cliché to Archetype. And we still got more. After that, yeah, we got three more quotes from the book Cliché to Archetype, and then we're finished that phase of what I've selected on those themes. So we got read these two quotes on camp.
All right. Camp is in quotes.
Yeah, first quote's from page 188, second is from page 189. These are on page 29 of my book.
Mm-hmm. Camp is a kind of dropoutism resulting from the new electronic environment. All the earlier forms go into quotes, as it were, when they have this new world to encompass them.
Second quote.
Camp is not a form but of retrieval, but rather simply rear-view mirror nostalgia. It's not a new service environment or cliché, but a means of escaping into the gingerbread world of mom and nursery.
Right. Now, I have a quote here on my McLuhan chart that Nelson put together, Nelson Paul. It's a good one, which is not in the book. It says, camp is popular because it gives people a sense of reality to see a replay of their lives. That would be added here if I had known that, had that quote at the time I put together the book. So we have the theme of replay, you know. We've been talking about retrieval and replay. And so camp is popular because it gives people a sense of reality to see a replay of their lives. With so much turnover, it's like having endless meaning, having endless meanings without the experience. Remember that whole point?
Mm-hmm.
So here we have camp as a kind of dropoutism. Now, he means by camp is people putting on old costumes is one of the cliche forms of camp, right? Putting on images of pretending you're Mae West or something, or the drag queens, they put on former Hollywood stars, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we move into this hyper-tactility, every previous form becomes an archetype, or as he says, in quotes. Remember, we go back to page 21 of my book, where he says, at the bottom, he says, using a quote from actually page 21 of Cliché to Archetype, since a cliché is a unit extension of man, that means like a probe extension of man, an archetype is a quoted extension, medium, technology, or environment. So when you're quoting, you're doing visual space. You're putting it into a framework, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that framework is known as camp, because he's saying all the earlier forms go into quotes, as it were, when they have this new world to encompass them. So that's like saying in Understanding Media, he outlines all the different media. Then he realizes they're merging by the late 60s, so he's just going to call all media a cliché archetype process, right?
Mm-hmm.
Retrieval, scrapping, extending. So you see he's dropping the terms television, radio, as separate environments, which existed before the satellite environment. And now that we're into a flux, a mixed media flux, or collective tactility, then all the content and forms of previous separate media go into quotes, and camp, you know, digs into that midden heap and creates performances and fads with that. And but it's a kind of dropoutism. You're not dealing with the present. You're just retrieving the past. So then you get the second quote. Camp is not a form of retrieval, but rather simply rearview mirror nostalgia. So he's qualifying that. This is the Andy Warhol world of, I forget their names, Jackie. You remember the Chelsea girls and then the drag queens, Jackie and Holly Woodlawn, and those people were in sort of popular movies like Trash that Warhol put out. Warhol was the artist of camp in New York City, late 60s, early 70s. So McLuhan is critiquing Warhol, saying he's just merging with tribal effects and not looking at the true artistic means available, which is to look at the figure ground, causes and forms, causes and effects, which you can do with modern pattern recognition. So he would see the Andy Warhol world as simple rearview mirror nostalgia or the gingerbread world of mom and nursery.
Because mm-hmm.
you're escaping back into, you're reacting to the present and not understanding why you have a nostalgia or
yeah.
kind of dropout.
Oh, I'm not too familiar with his films, but when I think about his paintings and his mixed media stuff, it was camp with a twist.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like watching You know, and as movies became popular about the 50s with the guys on the roller skates and the hamburger stands or whatever, it would throw you back into that time when you were a kid, and you know, and that's how life was for you. I mean, his art, as I think of it or recall it, it was camp because it brought back an image from the past, but he did it with a weird twist, which made it a little more than camp. It was campy, but it was more than camp.
Well, McLuhan explained the appeal of Warhol the best. I mean, Warhol he wasn't doing paintings anymore. He wasn't dealing with normal topics of cubism, fauvism, impressionism, or Renaissance painting, you know, the normal painting contents. He took whole environments as art form. And so he would hoik up images of Liz Taylor, Marilyn Monroe, all these images from the old mechanical software industries of Hollywood.
Yeah, but they weren't in nostalgic, true nostalgic form, because he'd put weird coloration into them, weird tints or color highlights or things.
He'd repeat
that them. Made them slightly surreal.
Yeah, and he repeat them.
Yeah.
So the power of Warhol's art was that he was expressing an effect. An immediate effect of the software electronic environment going around the old, you know, the television environment went around the old Hollywood movie environment, and which was more of a consumerist world of stars, whereas in television there were no longer stars, there were just personalities, and they didn't have such a hot image. So he immediately presented the old environment as art form, and it resonated with the fact that the old environment was becoming art form according to McLuhan's laws. Right?
Mm-hmm.